Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John with the Evolved Caveman podcast. And it's my are we good?
Okay. My internet connection keeps coming up as unstable, so I'm going to...
Let's stop the video.
Do you use the video?
We do, but it's not much. It's on YouTube. So let's just do audio.
Oh, okay. All right.
Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John with the Evolved Caveman podcast, and it is my pleasure today to have as my guest Sarah Elkins. And Sarah is a communication coach, a Gallup certified strengths finder coach, a keynote speaker, a new author, and a professional musician. Her podcast and book are both titled Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. And the podcast and the book help listeners and readers understand that the stories they choose to tell and how they choose to tell them impact their internal messages and the perceptions of people around them. Sarah knows that the key to satisfaction and happiness in life is healthy relationships, and the keys to healthy relationships are self-reflection and communication. Sarah, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming aboard.
Thanks so much, John. It's my pleasure to be here.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Absurdly well, I would say.
Oh, that's awesome. I'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
It was funny, to the listeners, we were just chit-chatting before the interview, and Sarah says kind of off the cuff, "Oh yeah, my friend is in two of my bands." And I was like, "How many bands do you have? And how many bands do you have?"
Well, my husband and I play in two bands together, and then I periodically am a guest vocalist for a jazz quintet.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wish I had musical talent.
It hasn't been so busy lately.
I guess so. All right, so let's start off with the question that I usually ask, which is, tell me a story of you at your very best. So starting with the story of struggle and then how you overcame that struggle.
Well, it's funny. I've been thinking, I have so many of these because I really think back at those struggles as opportunities. And so every time I've had a serious struggle, I keep coming back to what is the lesson to learn. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to actually go all the way back to, I had just graduated from high school. So this was decades ago. And my mom was a nurse at an overnight camp in Colorado. And I had gotten a job as a counselor there. And I actually got the job as a counselor and found out they were looking for a nurse. And my mom was in between jobs. And so I asked my mom to apply for the job so that we could spend my last summer together, because I knew that once I graduated from high school, I was unlikely to spend a lot of time with her. Mm-hmm. So she agreed to be the camp nurse that year. And it ended up being a really, really hard summer. The camp director, for some reason, I must have done something that wasn't right with her. But she was really mean to me and undermined me with the campers that I was supposed to be working with. And all summer long, I would be sitting with the campers, like at a meal, and she would come over and insult me in front of the campers and tell me that I wasn't controlling my girls well enough. Or she would say weird things and the girls would all kind of be puzzled by it. Huh. But I would be embarrassed, of course.
Yeah.
And it was a very strange summer. I'm not sure what she was going through for that to have happened, where she felt compelled to do that to a young woman. I mean, I was so young. I was 18 years old.
Yeah.
And she had to have been in her 30s. So it's puzzling to me, but I'm sure there was something else going on in her life that made this happen. But anyway, the summer was really hard and I cried a lot, and I'm not a crier. And, but almost every night I would go to the infirmary where my mom had her office and sleeping quarters, and I would just cry. And she would try to console me. And at some point I said, "Mom, I should just quit. I should just leave." And she said, here's the thing, Sarah. Every time something like this happens in your life, it's a trial. This is your test. You have a lesson to learn. That's what the universe is telling you, is that you have a lesson to learn. And if you leave, you give up before you've learned that lesson, it's going to keep coming back to you over and over again. And it may not be this person, but it'll be the same scenario. And you're just going to have this pattern until you figure it out. To this day, I think back on that, obviously. I mean, I'm still telling this story. I remember walking away from that, you know, drying my eyes and saying, she's right, I need to get through this. What is my lesson? And I remember finishing camp and going home and then starting my freshman year of college and not really thinking about it again until, you know, obviously I had other struggles and I would try to think of what the lesson was. But then all of a sudden, at 40 years old, you know, two decades later, I had a very similar experience with a particular boss. And there was this moment where I was standing in the bathroom of my eyes out. Again, very unusual. This is 20 years later. And I remember wiping my face, trying to clear the tears off my face and putting cold water on it so that I wouldn't look all puffy when I went back to my desk.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at the mirror and hearing my mother's words. This is 20 years later and countless jobs and countless relationships later. And I realized that I had some complicity in what I was experiencing because I hadn't learned that lesson. And it dawned on me at that moment, like, oh my gosh, this isn't the first time this has happened to me. This isn't the first time I found myself in this situation. And I'm having this, it's kind of like a movie where you have the flashbacks where you see little snippets of each time something happened and it like, oh my gosh, there's a pattern here. And that's what I saw in that moment. And it was
so what was your complicity in that dynamic? What was your part?
Well, there are two things. One is, and a lot of women do this more so than men, I think, we try to be really nice. We think that being nice is going to solve the problem. And I'm very nice. I'm a wonderful friend to have. If I'm going out the door, and back when I worked in an office, if I'm going to go out downtown to do something, I'll ask, does anybody need anything while I'm out? I'm going to go grab coffee. Does anybody want a coffee? That's the kind of friend I am. And what I found was that being nice like that didn't serve me when the other person, first of all, wasn't nice. Mm-hmm. And second of all, was threatened by me in some way. And being nice to people who are threatened by you makes them feel like they can step on you.
Right.
They stop taking you seriously. And that's, I kept falling into that pattern of trying to win them with kindness. And
yeah, if I can jump in there, it's an interesting double bind that women are in. That double bind is that, and forgive the language, but if you're too emotional in the workplace, you're weak, you're too weak. And if you're too assertive and even aggressive, then you're a bitch. And it's a double bind that women often find themselves in, and unfairly so. Because I think you're right. I think we all need to learn to be more appropriately assertive and stand up for ourselves in those situations, particularly when someone's walking on us or trying to walk on us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I didn't deserve to be bullied. There's no way in a million years that I would blame the victim for the bully's behavior. I can say, though, that there were opportunities, if I had understood myself better, what my strengths were, where I could have asserted myself in a way that was reasonable and professional. And right. I hadn't really done that yet.
And I think, I mean, the overall lesson of the story is very well taken in that, you know, I think it's one of the most powerful tools we can learn in this lifetime, and that is positive reframing. So we all have tragedy and difficulties and trials and tribulations. And the question is, what do you do with that? Those are inevitable. The question is, how do you make sense of it? How do you move forward in a positive manner? How do you not let those difficulties shut you down to relationships and life? And so I think, you know, that question of what's the lesson I'm supposed to learn here, is one of the most powerful questions that we have.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. And my mom doesn't remember saying that to me, by the way.
Yeah, I've had similar experience with my mom. But so you're a storyteller. And so tell me, I'm a typical guy. I'm like, why should I care about storytelling? Like, I got important stuff to do. I got goals to meet. I got objectives. I got to do some cold sales calling or, you know, so why should I care about sales or about storytelling?
Well, there are so many reasons, but let's just start with what you were just saying, that you're a guy and you don't really think about it in that way. But how many times are you with your guy friends or in a client meeting with all men that you share some epic story of a fish you caught or a celebrity you met? You share those stories all mm-hmm. the time. Why do you share them? Well, because you want to entertain. You want people to laugh. You want to feel connected to them. That's why we share those stories. That's why when you get together with your old buddies from high school or college, all you talk about is the memories of those stories of things that happened together. That it's our natural instinct to come back to that. So you're already sharing stories. Mm-hmm. And you just from those experiences, if you look back and you start to kind of just why you do that with your friends, you'll come to very basic knowledge that you do this to connect. So the same thing goes with any other relationship in your life. If you really want to connect with somebody, it's not necessarily by telling them a story that's going to connect you. It's telling them the right story that then unlocks the story of the person you're talking to.
So yeah. If I can jump in there, it's really interesting because I think to me, storytelling is all about connection and connection is all about emotion. I mean, even when I'm hanging out with my guy friends telling those stories, you know, it's an attempt, whether or not I'm conscious of it, to evoke some sort of emotion, you know, whether I want them to be kind of impressed with me or to laugh or to feel my hurt and pain or sadness. I mean, that's a little bit more evolved than most men, but, you know, we can go there. It was funny, we were watching The Secret Life of Walter Mitty last night, and there's a quote on the wall in the beginning from Life magazine. It's their motto, and it says, to see the world, dangerous things to see behind walls, to draw closer, to find each other, and to feel. That is the purpose of life. And I think that fits in really well with the storytelling idea.
Absolutely. That's the purpose of storytelling.
And it's funny, I remember when I had a radio show some 14, 15 years ago, and I was I was anxious and scared because I had never done radio. And I relied on like telling about studies and statistics and trying to share tools that would make people or help people to live a happier life. And what I quickly realized is that no one gave a shit because it was all analytical. It was all cold and lifeless. There was no emotion involved. And I realized that if I want to affect change in people, I had to learn how to tell stories because I think it's the stories. Storytelling is one of the most fundamental ways that we convey and learn information, largely because it has that emotional content to it. Mm-hmm. And that helps us. It helps us remember.
And not just any story. It's when you share a story that opens you up to a level of vulnerability, even if it's mild vulnerability, but enough that it allows a little peek behind the curtains into you, then it's a lot more likely that that person is going to listen to it, partly mm-hmm. because they trust. You know, that's a way to build trust is to demonstrate some level of vulnerability. But on the other side of that is, oh, this guy gets it. He's been there. Right. I mean, I'm not going to listen to somebody who hasn't experienced what I've experienced. How would they know?
Well, and one of the things I love about storytelling is that, you know, at that level of emotion, when we touch other people's emotions, we're all the same. You know, skin color goes away, ethnicity goes away, language goes away, and you can connect with anyone in the sense that we all feel emotions similarly. Mm-hmm. That Absolutely. Is a worldwide language.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so let's say I'm a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Again, why would I want to spend time becoming a better storyteller?
Well, let's go back to if you're a CEO of a major company and you think about the people who had an impact on you, you think about how they behaved around you. Why? What was it? Was it a positive impact? Was it a negative impact? Are you doing this because you're spiting somebody who told you you'd never amount to something? Are you spiting somebody who really didn't believe in you at the time? Or is there somebody who really did believe in you that helped you take the next step? Those are the stories, when you can share them, that help people see your vision for your company. And if you have a company that is, your intent is to make a positive impact, then you have to start with your own circle. So the people that you've hired and your first clients. And the only way they're going to share your vision is to feel connected to you. And the best way to do that is to tell them why. Why do you want to have this positive impact? Who inspired you to do that?
And
I just have to say, it's not the big story. It's not, you know, my dad was my greatest hero and this is why. It's what was the conversation you had with your dad that made you want to do this?
I just lost my train of thought.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I completely agree with you. And one of the things that I'll tell my clients is, I want you to have a bag of stories on your hip, a pretend bag of stories, but you know, come up with 5 or 6 stories that evoke different emotions from your life, that you practice them and get better and better at them. And the idea being that there's going to be times in conversations where you're like, oh, this story fits in perfectly here. And if you've practiced it enough, you can get in this flow where you're telling the story and because it's so automatic and unconscious, you don't even have to put that much attention into telling it. And then you can keep 20% of your attention to think, okay, where am I going next with this conversation?
That's a beautiful idea. I mean, and that's the book that I just recently published actually helps the reader create that story portfolio, that bag of stories on their head. That's...
Oh, you're breaking up a little bit. Oh, there we go.
Yeah. It's like a worksheet. You start with the era of a pivotal time in your life. That might be 7th grade. It might be freshman year of college. It might be first year of marriage or the first year at a certain job or when my father died. You know, it's an era. And then we dig in the book so that you can get very specific situations or events or experiences that then you can add detail to. And I love what you said about having that on your hip pocket so that you can actually practice it enough to get comfortable with it. So it's almost a subconscious way of sharing it. What that does is if 80% of your attention is on telling the story and making sure that you're connecting with your eyes and with your emotion, your facial expressions, then the other part of that can be focused also on what's next, but even more importantly, it's one person or 1,000
people. Oh, wait, you broke up there. So even more importantly.
Is to spend that time observing your audience.
Okay.
So whether that's one person or 1,000 people, paying attention to how they are responding to your story and making sure that you're pulling memories from them, that you're telling the story not to entertain and persuade necessarily, but to unlock their stories.
Yeah, and I think one of the good tools as a speaker there is to use the callback. Does that make sense to you? Have you guys felt that?
What do you mean?
A callback being like when you call out to the audience. So, you know, does that make sense to you? Have you felt that? Put your hand up, say yes, you know, if that means something to you. And just getting the audience moving and engaged and getting their heart rate up slightly.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And it gets them to start thinking about their own story that they would share if they had an opportunity next.
And I do like the question, have you ever felt that before? You know, if you're really an expert storyteller and you're evoking a specific emotion or set of emotions, to then say, you know, have you ever felt that before in your life? Mm-hmm. Just, you know, say yes if you felt that before.
Yes. And I'll often say, does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Or does that feel familiar?
And so what about vulnerability? Because that's been a buzzword lately, thanks to Brené Brown. And I think most men hear that word and they're like, oh, shit. So, and I think that's partly because I think it scares the shit out of them. And it is scary. What do you see as vulnerability?
Oh, I love that question because I kind of fit that more than most of the women I know. As a matter of fact, when I read your description of your podcast, I started to chuckle. And I think I wrote this in an email to you. My best friend and I, long before I met my husband, I was living in DC with this woman named Mary. And we were so close. And she invited me. She had gotten two tickets to the one-man show defending the caveman.
And oh, yeah.
It was hilarious. It was hilarious. But the irony was that we're sitting there as dates, you know, two women that we're not dating. And by the end of the show, we decided that if we were gay, we'd make a perfect couple because I was laughing harder at at how a man does things like shops. And she was laughing harder at how a woman shops. And so that whole idea of vulnerability, I get that cringe. It's kind of like so many people cringe when they hear about going to a networking event, like, oh God, I don't want to go do that. I feel the same way about vulnerability. And I think part of that is that sometimes I get really uncomfortable with emotion, with other people's emotion. And so I have to be able to take a step back and know that whatever they're doing is not reflecting on me, because that's where I would get uncomfortable. And when I talk about vulnerability and storytelling, I'm talking about telling a story that may not start with putting you in the best light.
Mm-hmm.
It may start with something that you generally don't like about yourself or are uncomfortable with, something you did or something you said or something you experienced that made you uncomfortable, and sharing it makes you uncomfortable.
Right.
But that's, I like to remind people that that's only 10 to 20% of your story. The setup is 10 to 20%. The rest of it is describing how you were resilient. What was the solution? How did it end?
Oh my gosh, we are such on the same page. That's why I asked you that question at the front of the podcast. And actually, that question is a positive psychology exercise. It's an introduction exercise. And I've done this before in a class where I was teaching psychologists and therapists. And I said, you know, instead of going around the room and, you know, kind of introducing us by rank, name, serial order, that kind of serial number, that kind of thing, like, you know, I'm Dr. John Schinner, I wrote a book, you know, I got a PhD from Cal, and everyone's okay. Like, fuck you. And you know, I think that doesn't connect us, right? And so this exercise really does, and it was amazing. This one man told a story about how he got a divorce from his wife, and it was a really contentious divorce, and, you know, kind of went into some detail about how he just wasn't at his best and didn't do some very nice things. And then after some time started practicing, I think it was loving kindness meditation, and he got over his anger and his hurt. And now him and his wife or ex-wife are good friends, and he can go over there and help on home improvement projects at her house, and they get along great. And I think that's a great example in a microcosm of this is me at my worst and this is me at my best. And that story arc is the story arc of every great comeback movie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I love that partly because what it does is it helps us focus on the solution instead of the struggle. And I know far too many people, like inspirational speakers, that start with a struggle and they go far too long with the struggle. Right. It ends up being 50 or 60% of the story. And then people are left feeling sad. And then you only leave, 30 to 40%, 50% of the time to share the application. What did I learn?
Right.
And that's the part that people need to connect with. They can connect originally with the struggle because they felt it. But if you really want to make an impact, you need to help them find a way out.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things in doing that one exercise in that class is the class felt palpably closer emotionally after that one exercise than we would have if we just, you know, shared where we worked and where we got our PhD and how many books we've written. And because that stuff doesn't connect you.
Exactly.
So the other thing that I wanted to bring up, because I think a lot of men out there are, as I said, scared to death of vulnerability. And it is scary when you first start. You know, I remember, as I said, I had the radio show and I realized wow, like I need to share that part of my makeup is depression and part of it's anxiety, because if I can't share that, who the hell can? Mm-hmm. And I was terrified to say that on the radio show. And I thought I would be heckled and mocked, and none of that came true. I did get some support from listeners, but it turned out to be not that big of a deal. But one of the things I want to share is that there's studies that show that when we ourselves are being vulnerable on a stage or on a podcast or a radio show, afterwards, we often think, oh my God, what did I just do? What was yes. I thinking sharing that? And then when we're in the audience and we watch someone being similarly vulnerable and sharing, you know, kind of the unpleasant parts of their character, we think, holy shit, that was so courageous.
Yeah.
And I think just to be aware of that difference in self-perception and other perception can help you get past that fear of learning to become more vulnerable.
Yes. And I think sharing stories is actually a really nice intro to sharing feelings and vulnerability, because you can tell a story that you know really well and share that with somebody. I think it's easier to do that than it is to just unload, this is how I'm feeling. I think I'd like to kind of go.
Oh, I lost you.
Part of that vulnerability.
Oh, say that again.
I'd like to go back to the whole why behind sharing stories, like what impact they have, because it has to do with this vulnerability conversation we're having. And that's so many of us, I haven't done this in many years because I've been married a long time, but I hear these stories from my friends, male and female, that they'll go out on a date and the person in front of them, all they can talk about is their ex. And it's ugly. And they're telling stories. They're not necessarily saying, oh, she was such a bitch, but they might say, oh, and then she did this. And then one time when we were on a date, she did this. Or he, when it's a woman talking about her ex-boyfriend, and I couldn't believe it when he didn't even do blah, blah, blah. So they're telling these stories. And what is the person in front of them doing? They're squirming.
Mm-hmm.
That first of all, they're thinking, oh, this is not pleasant. This isn't what I signed up for. And second of all, they're thinking, well, if we went out and then we broke up, is he going to be saying the same things about me that he's saying about her?
Yep.
He's talking behind her back. He's telling me what a horrible person she is. He's telling me all these stories about her. Is he going to do that behind my back if we go out and break up?
Well, and I really like that rule of thumb that you just shared with us about, you know, 20% roughly of your story should be that vulnerability piece, that piece when you're struggling. Because I actually, as I think of it, and I think back of when I was first starting to date after my divorce, and I was having a difficult time getting untracked from those negative things about my wife or ex-wife, because I would get hooked by anger or irritation. And mm-hmm. once you get there, you just kind of keep going on that track. It's hard to get off of it. So it's a good indicator of how ready am I really to date? You know, if you find you're telling more than 20% of your story and it's like, this is all crap, maybe you should go back and, you know,
do some self-reflection.
More self-reflection.
Exactly.
Well, you know, but really, maybe you're not ready, and maybe, you know, yeah, what's my complicity? What's my part? And I think that's always a good question too, because it's never one person alone.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And as I had that example of my boss that was abusive, she was really mean to me, and I didn't deserve it. And at the same time, I knew that there were some things that I could have done differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think so, even when you're being abused, you know, verbally, emotionally, what can I do to begin to be more assertive? What can I do to speak up for myself? Who can I talk to? How can I get more tools in this area? And even if it doesn't impact you in that relationship, it's still a good direction to take for future relationships.
Oh, that is such a great point. And I can tell you, I had a situation just a few years later when I had switched jobs. And luckily, this other woman wasn't my boss, but I had to work with her a lot. And it was a very similar relationship, except that she wasn't my boss. And at one point, she was angry with me and she was yelling at me. And I stood my ground. And I said to her, Well, there are a lot of things that I said, but I was I was addressing her behavior and I wasn't insulting her. Nice. I was thinking along the lines of what is her behavior that's unacceptable? So she was upset because I had done something. She said I did it behind her back. And I said, no, I asked my boss and he said that I could do it that way. And she said, well, he doesn't know. You should have asked me. And I said, you know, honestly, if I'm going to ask somebody mean to me,
you cut out there. So if I'm going to ask somebody,
if I have to ask a question and it can go to him or to you, it's going to go to him because you're not very nice to me. Mm-hmm. You talk behind my back. You're rude. You're dismissive of me when I walk in the door. I said, why in the world would I come to you with a question?
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there that think they can get what they want through force, intimidation, fear. And, you know, I think that was sort of part of the definition of alpha male when I was growing up. And I heard a new definition of alpha male, which I love, kind of along these lines. And that it's that the true alpha male is one that can get other alphas to cooperate through the use of communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's alpha female or alpha male.
That's right. Just that's why I left.
That's a leader.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a leader.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in that scenario, I remember walking away from that conversation with this woman after at one point, this is actually a funny one. She said, well, we will never be friends. And this is a woman that's 20 years older than me. And I couldn't help it. I had a little smirk on my face because it was such a ridiculous thing to say in a professional environment. I had a little smirk on my face and I smiled sweetly and I said, that's okay with me. And I walked away. We came to the conclusion that we would both try to be more professional or whatever it was. But I walked away and I have to tell you, John, I walked into my office and I felt so right. Not that I was right, but I felt good. I felt like I said exactly what I needed to say, that I handled it with grace and with compassion because I know there are other things going on with her and that that's part of why she's such a bitter and angry person. But at the same time, when I got home and I told my husband the story, now he's been with me through all of these situations and particularly the previous one where I was coming home and he would say, is it a martini night or scotch? That's how bad it was. And I came home that night and this is the next job. So I wasn't having that need for self-medication at that point. And I came home and I'm smiling and I'm feeling big. I'm feeling like, man, I finally learned that lesson after 20 something years. And I told him what happened. You know what he said to me? He said, you wouldn't have done that 4 years ago. He said, I'm so proud of you that you handled it exactly right.
Yeah. And you know, I think that's one of the purposes in life is simply growth. And it was funny. I was talking to a client earlier today and he was telling me that, you know, he hates TV shows and movies that completely lack character development. And he loved this one show because it had great character development and realized this is someone I've worked with for many years and progress has been painfully slow at times. And so I flipped it and I asked him, so where's the character development in your life? And he was like,
"That's
you
awesome.
Son of a," and so we went through it, but it gave me the screwdriver to pry open the old can of paint that is his heart and, you know, get
Ouch.
To it. Well, he's tough, man. I mean, sometimes it's tough sledding. It's a slog.
It's really painful to be that kind of self-reflective, to see where you're getting in your own way. That is so painful. The last thing anyone wants to do is say, oh, I was complicit.
Yeah.
And that sucks.
It's scary. I mean, because I think most of our lives we're trying to do impression management. We want people to like us. We don't want to disappoint. And so to actually look at it and go, wow, yeah, I really hurt that person. That was shitty. You know, it's funny because I remember when I was younger, I wanted to do something adventurous. And I thought, well, you know, space travel's already been kind of taken. We've already been to the moon. And We've already looked under most of the ocean, and you know, all the land on the planet's been explored pretty much. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go inward. Like, I'll explore my internal landscape, because that's definitely scary. And I think that that's what keeps a lot of men from doing it is, you know, it's scary as hell to turn it inward and look inside at your thoughts and feelings. I mean, there was a documentary about these 10 men in the maximum security prison that were going in for a 10-day silent Vipassana retreat, Vipassana. And they were interviewing them right before they went in. And these guys were scared out of their minds. They were like, look, I've spent my whole life running from what's in my head. The last place I want to be is in 10 days of silence with nothing but my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And that I get it. That makes complete sense to me. And because we fear it, you know, the only way is to go through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think part of that, when you go in your head, is you have to not only acknowledge where you were wrong, and you have to know internally you were wrong. And now that you know, now that that paint lid is off, what are you going to do with it? Mm-hmm. And I think in many cases that fear is, I don't want to be like my mother. I don't want to be like my father.
Mm-hmm.
And,
or I don't feel worthy. I think that's the other one that drives a lot of us. Like trying to do enough to feel worthy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know for me, oftentimes, now my mom is a wonderful, wonderful woman. And there are things that I swore up and down I wouldn't do, you know, as a mom. Well, I'll never do that. And there are some times where I'll hear my mom's voice come out of my mouth and I'm like, oh. Or one of my sons will say, okay, Bubby. That's what they call my mother, grandmother.
Ooh, that's a dig.
Okay, Bubby. It is. But I love it when they do that. It's painful, but I love it because it puts that spotlight back on. Like, oh, thank goodness, because I really don't want to go there. I really don't want to guilt you or obligate you to things. I want you to do this.
When my boys were young, they came to me. They were probably 8 and 10. And they said, hey, Dad, you know, we got to tell you something, that when you get angry, you repeat yourself a lot. And I was not aware of that. And I was like, oh, you mean like 2 or 3 times? Like, no. More like 7, 8. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, I had no ideas. I said, so let me take a look at that, and I will work on that. And thank you for sharing that with me. And, you know, so then I could work on this kind of stopping repeating myself. So I would keep it to, you know, once or twice. But, you know, a lot of times we get angry and we just don't have any awareness of what we're doing in the moment.
Well, and your answer at that point could have been, well, that's because you never listen.
yeah.
But instead, you reflected on it and thought, okay, if I repeat it once or twice or 3 times and the message isn't getting there, I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah, I need to change my communication style.
Yeah, what am I doing that's not working?
Hey, maybe they can't hear me when they're afraid, huh?
Oh, geez, you think?
What a thought.
That's a great segue,
because one of the things I wanted to talk about was the importance of safe spaces for people, I would say, to learn, to share their story, to hear. But, you know, it's funny because even as I use that phrase, safe spaces, I can hear certain people saying, oh, my God, here we go.
It's too woo-woo.
Yep.
Oh, you poor little snowflake. You're so delicate. You need a safe place.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's the thing about finding safe space, it's not about the location, and it's not even about the person necessarily. I find it to be more about who's listening. So if you are the person that needs to be listened to, you probably have somebody in your life that you can talk to that will listen without judgment. And maybe the same person is somebody you can say, I don't want a solution. I just need to talk about this. Because I'm one of those people, if you start talking to me, I'm going to start problem solving. That's just what I do. But if somebody like my son comes to me and says, Mom, I don't want a solution right now. I just need to talk about it. that's creating a safe place. Mm-hmm. If he knows he can say that to me and I can just listen, that's creating a safe place. And then the next aspect of that is to actually listen. And I'm finding more and more as I do these active listening workshops that it's so much more than people really understand in terms of communication. You cannot make a point. You cannot communicate to somebody well and clearly with any kind of clarity unless you yourself are actively listening. And that doesn't mean just listening to the sound of their voice. It means watching their body language as you speak. It means asking questions that help clarify their thoughts before you launch into what point you're trying to make. And again, that creates a safe place, a safe environment to share vulnerability and stories. And the stories are where you're going to learn about a person. Mm-hmm. So one of the references I use in my book is for career and professional storytelling. So this is if you have to speak in front of a group, or if you are a public speaker, you want to become a public speaker. Are you getting interviewed by the media? Are you interviewing for a job? And what I talk about is Lou Adler. He's this HR guru.
Yeah, I know Lou.
I love that guy. He wrote a blurb for my book, which is really awesome. But anyway, he says there's only one question you need to ask in an interview.
Oh, you're breaking up. There's only one question you need to ask.
Yeah, there's only one question you need to ask in an interview, and that is, tell me about a great accomplishment. It's that simple. But what Lou does is he goes on and he has these two lists that he provides when you're going to ask that question to somebody. One is a list of questions to help clarify what they're trying to tell you, so to draw their story out. And the other is a list of what you can learn about a person by listening closely to their story.
That's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, and I do agree with you. I think listening, good listeners are in short supply. I think we're in a short attention span theater in the world that we live in. I think that people are kind of more interested in, you know, shine the spotlight of attention on me. And the art of listening is drying up a little bit.
Oh, it absolutely is. And that's part of why communication has taken such a dive. I was just having a conversation with a coaching client that's so frustrated. He was talking about these two people that he works with, that one of them is an external processor. So mm-hmm. she basically is thinking out loud during mm-hmm. a meeting. So it's taking up the time and energy of all the people attending the meeting, and she's just externally processing. And what needs to happen is she needs to realize that that's what she's doing and either ask, can I externally process this with you? Or do I need to do that later with somebody else? Or just not do the external processing on a call like that. And I suggested to him that the biggest issue is that she's not listening. And he said, no, she likes the sound of her voice. I said, no, that's not what it's about. It's because she's not listening. And so she doesn't understand. She's not listening to herself, for one thing. And she's also not listening to the people around her that are trying to give her hints that this is not a good form of communication.
Yeah, and I see this pretty frequently. I see it a lot in men that, you know, kind of to the example you gave earlier of someone, like let's say your spouse wants to come home and vent, and most men are of that mindset of, I need to fix it. I need to solve the problem because mm-hmm. that's what we've been rewarded for doing our whole lives. But most of the time, your spouse just wants to come home and vent, and they just want you to listen. They don't want you to fix it, because often that message of fixing it implies that they can't fix it themselves. But what I find with most men is when they're listening to their spouse vent, they are empathetic. So they're picking up their spouse's distress, whether it's hurt or anger or sadness, and it creates discomfort internally in them, and they can't handle that internal discomfort. And so they're compelled to speak out and try and fix it because all this is happening without awareness, but they can't sit with that discomfort. because we've never been taught to.
I never thought about it that way, John, but you're absolutely right. And now, like, I'm having these flashes of memories of conversations where I did that, where somebody was sharing something with me, and that emotion made me uncomfortable. And so I wasn't listening as well as I could have. Mm-hmm. And I do have a strategy to address that. This is what I do a lot.
Awesome.
Because I'm a coach. It's what I do as a coach. When I find myself getting uncomfortable like that, I will start really thinking about clarifying questions. So instead of approaching it with, oh gosh, this is making me uncomfortable, I start approaching it with curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm not going to think about why I'm uncomfortable until later. I'm going to focus on the person in front of me. I'm going to ask them questions like, wow, it sounds like you were really frustrated. What do you think triggered that? What do you think happened before that that set you up to be triggered?
Mm-hmm.
Where were you when this happened? Who was in the room with you? Have them really get to a very clear, vivid memory of what happened so that they can start putting it together as, oh, this really wasn't about me. Or
the other tool right there is when you bring them back into that situation, you can have them focus on a relaxation technique, like focus on deep breathing and calming your physiology. Because at that moment, they're reliving it kind of like a traumatic response. So if they can relax into the memory, often they can let it go more easily.
Yes. And find context for it. Because right mm-hmm. now, there's no context for it. It's just anger or sadness.
The question of how much of this has to do with me.
Exactly.
To your point earlier, you know, is this about me or is this about, I don't know, my coworker's father who yelled at her this morning, or, you know, the boss got a flat tire on the way to work, or the boss's son is, you know, addicted to ecstasy. So he was up all night and now he's irritable at work.
Right. Exactly. Was this really about me? And if it was, what role did I play in it? Mm-hmm. And what can I do? And then I want to go back to that important part about not addressing my discomfort in that moment. Why am I uncomfortable with this person's emotion? I don't want to address that at that moment because the person in front.
Oh, we lost you for a second.
Oh.
Because the person.
So it can't be about me.
Mm-hmm.
That discomfort and my emotion, my discomfort at living through somebody else's emotion, it can't be about me in that moment. It has to mm-hmm. be about them. And yet, it is critical that after the conversation, I take some time to process that question. Why did that make me so uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't start thinking about, you know, what your triggers were, and I think in most cases, when you come back to that example of the spouse trying to tell you something and you just get upset about it, when I was being abused in that situation, I would come home and I would be so sad or so frustrated. And my husband would listen for a little bit, but then I could see that he was so upset that I was upset. It broke his heart. It broke his heart.
It's hard.
Like that. It is.
We don't want the people that we care about to suffer.
Exactly.
And that part makes sense, but then sometimes the way we deal with it causes more suffering.
Exactly. So that's why it's so important to take a step back.
To your point, I will use those internal cues. Like if I'm feeling anxious or if I'm starting to feel angry as a result of someone telling me a story, I may stop and use that as a diagnostic in the sense that, gee, you know, let me interrupt you for a second. I find that I'm feeling a little bit angry right now. Were you feeling angry in that moment?
Mm-hmm.
Or were you, how uncomfortable were you? Because right now I'm really uncomfortable and I'm picking up, you know, discomfort from you telling the story.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful. That's a great strategy.
Sometimes.
Because you can address your own at the same time.
Right. And so I don't think I'm making it about me. I'm just using my empathy, my internal physiological cues to figure out what's going on with them. And the other way I use this with anxious clients, you know, a lot of times they're socially anxious. So like I had a college student that was anxious when he would go into a party, like a bigger party on campus. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, what I'd suggest is go up to the door, let's say it's at a fraternity house, and take a few deep breaths, ground yourself like we worked on. So bring your physiology down, bring your heart rate down, and then enter the house. And then, you know, look for someone to start a conversation with. And when you start the conversation, pay attention to what's going on in your body, in your chest, in your neck, in your stomach. And if you pick up any signs of being anxious, just interpret that as the other person's anxiety. I don't care what the truth is in that situation. What I'm more concerned about is which interpretation serves you best in that moment. Because either one could be true. It might be my anxiety. It might be her anxiety that I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. But it serves me best in dealing with my anxiety to just think, oh, she's really anxious. I'll try and calm her down. I'll try and make her feel safe.
Yeah. That's actually something that I recommend when you're going to a networking event and it's not your thing. Like if you have to, mm-hmm. is finding somebody else who clearly feels uncomfortable where they are. I mean, that's the easiest way to make a friend is to go over and say, hey, I'm feeling really awkward here. How about you? Well,
it also gets the spotlight of attention off of us and onto helping someone else, which helps
with
being slightly depressed or slightly anxious, because we, in those states, we'll over-focus on ourselves.
Yeah, that's always the case. Absolutely.
So in wrapping up, let me ask you the difficult question of which question did I not ask you that I should have?
Well, you asked me earlier before we hit record, you asked me to share a story.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yeah?
Would you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's my thing.
Perfect. Then it fits.
Yes. I actually told this story, and I'll shorten it, but I told this story at a performance. It was the 25th anniversary of Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It.
And they did fantastic. This.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was a huge event over a long weekend in Missoula, Montana. And I got to tell this story on the stage of the Wilma Theater, which is a very famous old theater. And the theme of the stories that a few of us from the community were sharing was Up the Blackfoot, because the story of A River Runs Through It takes place on the Blackfoot River coming through Montana.
Okay.
When we moved to Montana, I had been fly fishing in Washington, D.C. area. My husband taught me to fly fish when we first met. And so I knew how to cast in rivers like the Shenandoah and the Potomac, which are generally kind of slow, easy rivers. And I got pretty good at certain casting. And so when we moved to Montana, I was pretty excited to try it out. It was our first summer here, and we were out on the river, and I had our 8-month-old son, who already weighed 20-plus pounds. I had him in the backpack on my back. And I had cut-off jeans and Tevas on. And my husband and I had split. He went upstream, and I went slightly downstream on this river. And I was casting a woolly bugger that I had made. So I only tied 3 flies in my entire life, and they were all 3 woolly buggers because they're generally pretty easy. They're supposed to emulate a minnow. And I was in this river, and I had just waded in up to about and the baby was asleep and he's kind of leaning to one side.
Sorry,
and
how deep
I'm
was the
casting
water?
To the other side of the river. It was probably about mid-calf.
Okay.
Maybe a little higher. Now, let's get some background here. I am 5 foot nothing. And at the time, I weighed about 110 pounds and I had a 20-pound baby on my back.
Okay.
So my legs are very strong, but they're like toothpicks coming out of my leg. I mean, it's really, I'm a small, petite person. So I was standing in the water, and the water's moving pretty fast, and I'm casting to the other side of the river, and I could see some reeds sticking out. I just knew there was a big trout in there, and I knew he was going to take my woolly bugger. So I'm casting to the same spot and letting the woolly bugger go down into the stream. And I'm, you know, pulling it back up and casting again. So this is on the opposite. And I start reeling in my line, and it's stuck. And I'm doing everything I can to unstick this woolly bugger because I didn't want to lose it. It's you know, I tied it myself.
Right.
And I'm going deeper and deeper into the water, which is moving pretty fast because it's only June. And I'm not even noticing how deep I'm going because I'm so focused on getting my woolly bugger out of those reeds. And eventually I pulled hard on my leader and it snapped. And I looked up and I realized not only had I lost my fly, but the tip of my rod had broken off.
Oh.
And I was so aggravated. So I very slowly turned downstream so that I could turn my body around and face back to the bank where I had to go. And I realized that I was over my knees in fast moving water with a baby on my back whose feet, because I'm short, were nearly touching the water.
Okay.
And I'm looking across and it's suddenly, you know, in movies where you have the hallway that seems to get longer and longer mm-hmm. as yep. you're walking further. And it's like a horror movie. That's how it looked to me because the water was just moving. So I very slowly have my fly rod in one hand and I'm very carefully balancing myself, trying to move slowly back across the water. And of course, my Teva hit a rock. So the rock went between my toe and the inside of my Teva and I went down. And I caught myself with my left hand and my right hand with the rod still in my grip. I caught myself and literally I'm looking up to keep my chin out of the water. And it's rushing by me and I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm waiting for the baby to shift, to wake up and shift and scream because he had been asleep and I saw his hand, it was like slow motion, drop down into the water. And I thought he was going to scream. It's cold water.
Right.
And instead, I could see him his little fingers tapping on the top of the water surface. And he goes, ooh, just like that. So thank goodness we didn't have a screaming, squirming baby in my backpack as I'm trying to not drown. So my biggest fear was that I was going to push myself up too hard and then fall backward because we both would have drowned. And I'm trying not to panic because I know that that is the worst thing that I could possibly do is panic. So right. I'm calling out to my husband, Bob, trying not to scare the baby. And he can't hear me. He's way upstream. And I'm so close to the water. There's no way that I can scream loud enough to get help. So I started moving, just crawling a little tiny bit at a time, trying to make sure that I didn't lose whatever buoyancy I had. And eventually I pulled myself out of the water. And to this day, I don't know, you know, you get kind of superhuman adrenaline going. And I finally pulled myself out of the water. And of course, we're both soaked. And my husband just then comes around the corner as I'm barely standing up and trying to take the backpack off so I can put the baby down. And he looks at me, he says, "Did you go for a swim?" I was so upset and I looked at him and tears just started dribbling very slowly down my face. And I told him what happened. And at the last second, I showed him my fly rod and I said, "And I lost my fly."
Oh, that's a great story.
He looked at me, he said, "Well, Sarah, you're officially a Montana girl."
Wow. Well, I'm glad everyone was safe. And
yes.
Fortunately, I didn't have to fix anything. So that was great.
Yeah. Nobody did. Nobody did. But I can tell you, I was not used to that kind of water yet. And
I bet.
My husband, he even asked, he's like, "Do you want me to take the baby?" I said, no, I got this.
Oh, man. So Sarah, in wrapping up, tell people where they can get your new book, Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will.
Thank you, John. Yes, it's on Amazon.com, the paperback and the hardcover. There will be an audiobook in probably about 2 to 3 months. And I'm encouraging people, if you don't want to use Amazon, I know a lot of people are kind of steering away right now. Bookshop.org is a new organization, and they support. And my book is there, and it's actually a buck cheaper if you buy it on bookshop.org. So I'm encouraging people to support their independent booksellers.
Fantastic. And the podcast is also Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will.
Yes.
So you can check out more of Sarah there.
Thank you. Yes. And you can go to my website, elkinsconsulting.com, just like it sounds, Elkins, E-L-K-I-N-S, consulting.com. And if you scroll down on that first page, you'll see the links to all of the different places where you can find my podcast.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I greatly enjoyed this conversation. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.